All right, so Chairman, how are you doing with these questions? You feeling comfortable?
No, I mean, I'm doing all right, but you asked me these really complicated questions.
Well, because I know you can answer them.
But you were asking for complicated answers, and then you immediately start looking at the timer, and it makes me want to have to speed up and limit what I'm having to say. If you feel like I'm giving too much of an answer, you just need to give me some kind of solid sign that I need to stop talking.
Something like this?
Something like
Chairman,
this.
Chairman, cut it.
That's what I'm saying.
I can do that.
This episode is brought to you by Texas Mutual Insurance Company, the state's leading provider of workers' compensation insurance. Since 1991, Texas Mutual has been helping employers prevent workplace accidents. To learn more about how Texas Mutual provides a competitively priced source of workers' comp insurance for Texas employers, visit www.texasmutual.com. Welcome to Austin Hires Local, your inside access to the work behind workforce development, powered by Workforce Solutions Capital Area. Join us as we dive deep into conversations with trailblazers across the local, state, and national workforce development ecosystem. From elected officials to industry leaders and educators, we uncover candid insights and innovative solutions shaping our workforce landscape. Get ready to explore the intersection of education, economy, and opportunity. This is Austin Hires Local, where the future of our workforce begins.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Austin Hires Local podcast. My name is Tamara Atkinson, and I have the privilege of serving as the CEO, Workforce Solutions Capital Area, where we have on-the-record conversations with workforce leaders from our community, across the state, and sometimes from around the country. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by the chairman of the Texas Workforce Commission, Brian Daniel. And we're going to talk to the chairman today about a number of things. Chairman, I have a sense that you've got some insights into middle skills. So I'm hoping you'll talk to us about middle skills and maybe what keeps parents up at night about middle skills, soft skills, and maybe you'll share a few stories about some soft skills faux pas, if you will, and labor force participation. I'd like you to describe what that is, why you track it, and maybe something surprising about that.
Right.
Are you game for having this conversation?
Man, I am ready to have this conversation.
All right, let's jump right in.
All right.
So workforce development, that's what we do. I love to start with a job question with all my guests for the podcast. So my first job question is, what was your first job?
So my first job was driving a tractor for a local farmer. My first job that was not in agriculture, I was a cook and a truck stop.
And how old were you for these jobs?
Oh, I started working for local farmers when I was probably 15 or 16, I would say. I took the job as a cook in a truck stop. I was the summer between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college. Everybody should be a cook in a truck stop once. You learn a lot about people when you do that.
Now, what's something you learned being a cook in a truck stop?
Well, I think I worked the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift.
Wow.
And you got a lot of tired truckers then. And I think you learn kind of how to get people to tell you their story. These were fascinating stories. So our truck stop had a counter in it where everybody ate. So, and I was the cook behind the counter. Mm-hmm. So I could cook and talk to
kind of like a diner, yeah. Like I'm picturing an old school diner.
Yeah, so yeah. Similar to that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would be able to talk to the truckers while they ate, while I was cooking up the next meal. And I was fascinated. I don't know if it was my cooking or what, but people drove thousands of miles to be there. So, obviously they had a lot to say.
Just for your cooking.
Maybe nobody ever said different.
I think that's right. Now, before we start rolling, you mentioned something about a lifeguard job. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, so I grew up down in the Lower Grand Valley, mm-hmm. and they decided we all needed to be certified lifeguards. So we went
everyone in the whole city?
No.
All the young people?
No, I think maybe just the group I ran with. I don't know. I wasn't
troublemakers.
I was not in charge back then. I was but a wee little tyke of 10 or 11 or 12 years old or something like that. And so we had what was then called Texas State Technical Institute, TSTI. You would know them as TSTC today, okay. Texas State Technical. And there was a campus in Harlingen on an old Air Force base there. And they had a pool, and that's where we took swim lessons when we were little tykes. And then somehow or another, my crew decided we needed to be lifeguards. And so I wanted the patch to sew on my swimsuit that said I was a lifeguard. And so I did that. Never could get anybody to hire me. I don't think I was old enough to actually be hired as a lifeguard, but I was certified. And at that point in my life, I'd sure sure be quick to tell you that I was a certified lifeguard because I felt like people should know that.
You know, fun fact for guests that I've had on this podcast, several of them have been lifeguards as a first job. No, I think it's a common first job.
I think it's a great first job. And you know, and my oldest daughter was a lifeguard. She did that for a couple summers. There's so many pools in the Central Texas area. Cities, you know, city of Georgetown where I live, I mean, I think the city has 4, 5, 6 pools, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they're always short. I mean, if I was a young person today, you go take the test. There's a written test and a little bit of a physical test because you got to be able to swim and you got to be able to perform some life-saving deals. But they'll do the certification there. I mean, if I was trying to figure out what I was going to do for the summer and I was 16 again, lifeguard. I mean, what a great job. You get to sit outside. They give you a little shade. You blow the whistle every once in a while.
Yell at kids, tell them to stop running.
They don't. I think you can yell at the kids. I think they've probably refrained from that.
Yeah.
I mean, stop running. I mean, first of all, you should know that. But I think that's not as big a problem as people horsing around in the pool and some things like that.
Did you ever save anyone's life?
I never saved anyone. In a pool,
or otherwise.
I did one time at camp. And we probably shouldn't talk about this, but the statute of limitations.
All the more reason why you should talk about it.
You know, that's true, right? No, so I did one time at a summer camp. I don't know what happened, but the guy like really panicked. And there were two of us. We got him out of the pool and got him calmed down. He was fine. He was never in any danger. He did not need to be resuscitated. He just needed to get out of the water so he could find some balance. But I don't like to talk about it because my lifeguard certification had expired at that point. So that was extracurricular lifeguarding.
I see. Okay. Know. Well, we won't write you up for that.
Well, it was long ago, 40 some years ago. So
these jobs that you talked about seems to me entry level jobs, right? Mm-hmm. These jobs that you had. But one of the things that you have been leading at the Texas Workforce Commission is around middle skill jobs. So mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a question about middle skill jobs. But because you are a man of data and stats, I thought I would give you some stats.
Oh, perfect.
Texas currently has 545,557 job openings with over 229,000 in middle skill roles. Mm-hmm. That's nearly 42% of all open jobs. So how is TWC doubling down on that middle skill sweet spot, particularly for those that don't have a 4-year degree, but they want to work?
It's not a simple or straightforward answer. The answer to your question is we're doing a lot of work in this regard because employers are telling us that they're having a hard time hiring people in these middle skills jobs. And I think that alone would cause us to want to have some type of program to encourage people to pursue this. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it at all, and if you spend any time whatsoever trying to see, like, why are we having openings here? Why are employers telling us? Mm-hmm. What you start to find is people aren't really being encouraged to go into these jobs. Mm-hmm. Now, think about it like this, because parents get on edge when I start talking about this, because no one wants their child to come home from school in the 10th grade and say, my teacher said I should not go to college, that I should take this other course of study. And I don't know a parent who doesn't probably harbor this idea that my kid's going to finish high school, they're going to go to college, they're going to do these great things. And so teachers, I think, in a lot of instances, are very reluctant to talk about, well, I mean, there's 55-ish% of the jobs in the state are in this middle skills area. And I think it's an awkward conversation for teachers to have with parents. And I don't blame them for not wanting to upset the apple cart, because we've convinced ourselves in Texas that everyone needs to go to college. I think that's great. Truth is college degree holders, baccalaureate or higher, they make more money over their lifetime. They tend to stay employed longer when there's an economic downturn. You will see a lot better outcomes for people who go to the university, get a university degree, and then get a job. But we're misreading that statistic. That's happening because the jobs that require university degrees are much more stable jobs, and they tend to stay really stable in the economy. But when you look at what I would consider to be top-tier middle skills jobs, the salaries are in some cases equal to or more than university degree requiring jobs. The stability of that job in the marketplace equal to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when have we ever heard about electricians, you know, losing their jobs during a downturn? You may be impacted by a downturn in terms of new construction or something like that, but people still need repairs.
So you mentioned electricians. What are some other examples of what would classify as middle skills?
Yeah, so middle skills jobs are going to be any job that requires some kind of training after high school, but doesn't really require a university degree. So plumbers, HVAC specialists, a lot of computer coders. That used to be
in the healthcare field.
Healthcare, you've got. Yeah. Oh goodness, healthcare is really a big issue for us in this right now, because phlebotomists, patient care technicians, certified nurse assistants, all middle school jobs. Truthfully, licensed vocational nurse would be a middle skills job. RNs start to become, they want you to have a BSN. I get that. There's a lot of things nurses have to do. So you've got, you know, four or five jobs that are in a natural sequence in healthcare that really do become middle skills jobs. And the key is helping people navigate how they're going to get that training. You start in high school, but I mean, who has a clear idea of their career when they're 16? Not very many people.
Right.
And so we can start to help them develop some aptitudes, but it's really going to happen post high school. And it's really going to happen in a sequence of things that they're not in complete control of, because they're going to take a job. They're either going to want to get a different or better job, or they're going to want to progress where they are in the workforce. And so helping people get the skills they need for the 200 and something thousand jobs that are open that you were talking about, that requires a little bit of planning. It requires a little bit of effort on educational providers' part, on the part of the people that are in the workforce. And TWC, where I work, and the boards where you work, one of the things I think we're really good at is helping facilitate those conversations so that people can understand where those entry points are, how you get the additional training, and then how you apply that to work yourself through the workforce. The end goal, middle skills or otherwise, but particularly in middle skills, the end goal is we need to make sure that the entire Texas workforce, all 15.5 million of them, are maximizing their full potential in the workforce. And when you start looking at those statistics, particularly when you lay the middle skills statistics over those, I think it becomes pretty clear pretty fast. There is more for people to do. And if they're really going to maximize what they're able to do in the workforce, which means more money, you know, better use of their time, better long-term potential, I think it has really been significant for TWC to get very involved in this space, for me to become, I mean, you were very kind when you mentioned how much I talk about middle skills jobs. I mean, I'm not the hit of the party. People don't always want to hear about this. But I think all the talking we've done about it has really raised awareness to the point where both employers and the workforce are like, okay, middle skills, we got that. But like, how are we going to get this done? Mm-hmm. That conversation, I think we're starting to see a lot of return on our investment in that.
Okay, thank you. Chairman, I had a leader about a year ago when I was talking to this leader about middle skill jobs. This leader said, nobody likes to be middle. Nobody wants the middle seat on an airplane. And this is what this person said. No one wants to be the middle child. I don't know if I agree with that. I'm the oldest, but
yeah, same here.
My question for you is, do you think part of our issue in Texas around having the conversation about middle skill jobs is the fact that we use the term middle? Should we be calling it something else to make it more appealing?
No, I don't agree. You know, we're always wanting to relabel things because we think the broad label that we've given something causes people to shy away from that or not want to participate in that. But like, what would you change it to? If we don't call it middle skills, what are we going to call it to? Pick some essential skills jobs. Uh-huh. Okay.
Power skills.
Power skills.
Yeah.
No one wakes up and says, I'm going to get me one of those power skill jobs. No one wakes up and says, I'm going to get me one of those middle skills jobs.
That's true.
We call it middle skills because I think that is just the government classifying like what it takes to get there. Now, if we do it a disservice, and I don't think calling it middle skills does, there will be a lot of people lining up to argue with me. But I don't think that causes any problems because no one is thinking in those terms. They're thinking, I would like to be an electrician, or I would like to be a nurse, or I would like to be a dental hygienist or a construction person. And they're really thinking about, like, what's my entry point into this job that I've chosen? Mm-hmm. And we can call it anything we want. I think if we called it something else, I think we would really want to stress the fact that it is just an alternative educational route to getting where you're going. So one of my daughters is an attorney. Mm-hmm. So she had 4 years of undergraduate education, 3 years of law school education, 7 years. To be a master electrician in Texas, you're looking at 8 years of instruction. And so it's not as if being an electrician is easier or faster to get to than being an attorney. It's just a different job with different skills and different qualifications. And the upside for income for a master electrician, I mean, it's really good. And anybody that owns their own electrical business is a master electrician. Attorneys do well because we need attorneys. Electricians do well because we need electricians. And so I think these are all kinds of critical skilled jobs for the economy. But for some reason, 3 decades ago, we started minimizing things that felt like, I don't know, blue-collar jobs, vocational jobs.
Yeah, I think it's true, yeah.
And
I saw it in my own high school.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, I get it, you know, and especially in that, I graduated high school in 88, and—
Hey, so did I.
There you go. And, you know, in class 88, we were really just starting this transition of, you don't want to be an electrician. You want to go to college and do this other thing. Mm-hmm. And that sounded really good. Mm-hmm. And it made sense to all of mm-hmm. us mm-hmm. because we were having a hard time filling college degree jobs in 1988.
Sure.
Now we're having a hard time filling jobs that require these more vocational kind of skills. And I think that's, in some ways, it's just the natural cycle of what happens in the workforce and education. But no, I appreciate what your leader told you, but we get hung up on labels, but nobody actually calls it that. We call it that in the government because we're trying to differentiate, like, how you actually get those skills. You're not going to get a degree in electricianing. You're going to go become an electrician. And there's a whole different set of training for that that's going to happen in a different way than if you went to the university to do that.
So, Chairman, you were talking about how over time we've changed what as a society, we've changed what we emphasize. When you and I were in high school, vocational education, things that lead to middle skill jobs, de-emphasized. I've been in workforce development for 25 years, and something that hasn't changed that I've heard from employers from the start is around soft skills, aka here's where the semantics come in. You know, pre-employment skills or employment-ready mm-hmm. skills. We can use different labels, but it relates to a category of skills that employers continue to tell us they feel like job seekers, workers are sometimes lacking. I'm wondering, what do you think is, first of all, how do you define a soft skill or what soft skills are? And then what do you think the answer is to this seems like perennial issue around employers saying job seekers, workers don't have soft skills?
Yeah, this is a huge topic of conversation for employers. And mm-hmm. And rightly so. Mm-hmm. I think we are starting to see people enter the workforce, and maybe have been for the last 4 or 5 years, that they don't have the same level of soft skills, essential skills, critical skills, call it whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter to me. They don't have these people-to-people skills that we, in some ways, sort of took for granted in the workforce. But mm-hmm. let's be real honest. I mean, in 1988, anybody who had been in the workforce for 10 years in 1988 thought everyone graduating from high school in 1988 had no idea what they were doing. And
that probably was right.
Because you don't, you know, 18 is a glorious age because you know everything except for what you don't know, which is most things. And I think it is a manifestation of this idea that, well, they're young, they don't know. That's probably true in some ways. But I also don't think people are getting these lessons at home like they once used to. You know, like I can go on my phone and order an entire meal to be delivered to my house and left on my front door. I don't have to talk to another human being at all, mm-hmm. ever.
Yeah.
In 1988, if I even wanted a pizza, I had to call, talk to a human being, get the order right, mm-hmm. pay the driver when they arrived at my house. Mm-hmm. And then
think about tipping them.
Yeah. Well, in 88, you know, Domino's pizza, $3 a pizza, you're going to kick in that extra 30 cents. It's worth it, you know. Keep the change. And you know, now you have a pizza. That's it. That was about the only thing you could order delivered was pizza. And that was only if you were in any kind of, you know, city or big town or college town or something like that. I don't think people are getting these skills at home the way they used to. I think homes just changed that much. I think it's in the course of their daily life. So we want people to be good with people. But when does a high school student, beyond their teachers and maybe a few people their parents know, when do they ever interact with another people? I mean, you can get everything you want off of a mail order, off of an app. And so what I think we're finding out is in particularly in most entry-level positions, you're going to be a retail sales clerk. You're going to interact with people in a way that you haven't been doing that. And of course you don't know how that works, and of course you're uncomfortable with it. But employers, particularly if they're my age, they don't remember a time when they didn't have those skills, because they really probably did enter the workforce with them, because we lived in a different world, you know, that long ago.
So are you leading, is the answer then the employers have a responsibility for and need to have patience with those entry-level workers?
I think employers, you know, I think their creation of jobs is what they're best at and running their business, and we should let them do that. I think we should listen to them. Mm-hmm. And if they're telling us this is an issue, I think we should really find ways to mitigate that issue much earlier than we are right now. Mm-hmm. So if I'm an employer and I've got an employee with great technical skills and bad people skills, am I going to have patience? Yeah. If they have bad technical skills and bad people skills, am I going to take a chance on them? Probably not, because there's other people that want to work. And so I think for employers, it's finding that right combination. I think for schools, it's finding a way for students to get these skills. And I think for people who are in more broadly workforce education, workforce development, you know, I think our job is to find ways to plug those employers up with the people who are training their workforce, future or present, and make sure that we have everything on the table and that we can find effective ways to teach people the skills that they need.
Have you ever seen an effective soft skills certification? Have you ever seen anything that can certify Tamara's got these skills, she's good to go?
I don't know of a single certification that does that. I think when you look at options that students have available to them, so schools, there's actually a TEKS for this in Texas. They can actually teach this, and I'm sure there's some certificate they can give them. I don't think most employers would recognize what that is. But if I know someone has been in 4-H or DECA or FFA or any of the kind of known student organizations, I can make a pretty educated guess that they're going to have those skills. If I'm looking and seeing that someone played any kind of UIL sport, tennis, football, baseball, doesn't matter, I know that they're used to working with other people and they're used to working in an environment where things are kind of bigger than they are. I think employers can look at people's experience and probably have an expectation about what that person's going to be like when they get them into the workforce.
This episode is brought to you by Texas Mutual Insurance Company, the state's leading provider of workers' compensation insurance. Since 1991, Texas Mutual has been helping employers prevent workplace accidents. To learn more about how Texas Mutual provides a competitively priced source of workers' comp insurance for Texas employers, visit www.texasmutual.com.
The extracurricular, the things that the students are involved in, matters.
Oh, it matters so much. And we're teaching these kids to be resume boosters in high school. Mm-hmm. And they belong to every club in the school because they want to show 23 clubs.
But none of them are meaningful.
Well, they're all meaningful except didn't get deep enough in any
that's
of
what
them
I
to
meant.
Get anything
they're not,
out
they're,
of
you know, you have a meaningful.
The experience wasn't meaningful.
That's what I meant. Yeah, you know, that's
like,
right.
Like if we knew somebody had 23 jobs and they're still looking for a job, and we're going to be like, okay, like what is it you're not like getting to? And this, like we turn these kids out of high school. They think they're going to go to college because they've belonged to 23 clubs. Mm. I'd rather you belong to 3 clubs for 4 years each. Mm. I'm going to see a lot more growth in you as a person if you actually did that. And I don't know. We've taught kids some bad habits in terms of what we tell them we think employers and colleges and others want. I don't think it's all that grounded in reality.
You were talking about things that employers might raise their eyebrows about. You've been at the Texas Workforce Commission for a while, and in your role, you get to see a lot of instances and hear a lot of stories. I'm wondering, when we think about soft skills, have you come across a soft skills faux pas that made you laugh or that was noteworthy, that stands out, and something that someone did that you can't believe they did and you think people should know, don't ever do that?
I have actually had more than one employer tell me that some employee ate another employee's whole lunch out of the break room refrigerator.
And we're not supposed to do that?
You're not, Tamara, please stop eating other people's lunch out of the break room refrigerator.
Okay.
No, I, in my world, in my mind, the world I grew up in, like, I would never dream, like, I didn't pack that lunch. That's not my lunch. Now, I may ask you for one of your French fries if you're eating your lunch back there, and I walk by and smell the French fries.
But only if I'm eating it in your presence.
And I'm going to ask you, hey, like, do you want to share a French fry with me today? I have actually had employers tell me, oh, yeah, they took somebody's whole lunch out of the refrigerator, ate the lunch, and never said a word about it. And I'm like, that seems silly that we would have to tell somebody that. But apparently we have to tell somebody that. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. If you're good at text messaging, but you don't want to talk on the phone, I mean, like, you're going to have to talk on the phone. Mm-hmm. If you're good at talking on the phone, but you don't like to talk to people in real life, IRL, well, maybe you need to practice talking to people in real life. Because if it's a thing that employer needs you to do, these are not unreasonable things to ask. Mm-hmm. Don't eat other people's lunch. If you need to talk to people, talk to people. Mm-hmm. You may feel put upon for this, but the fact is these are very reasonable things that the employers are laying out. I've heard like really funny stories. And little known fact, although right at the core of my job, we adjudicate hundreds of contested unemployment benefit cases every week. And there have actually been cases that rose to the commission level that were complete and total soft skill faux pas that just escalated to the point where someone lost their job.
Can you give an example?
Well, probably not supposed to, but for example, we've had one employee tell another employee something about the lunch that they brought, and they actually got into a physical altercation over that, and then were shocked when they were dismissed to find out that you really can't have a physical altercation at the workplace. Drive-through window workers making threats to customers coming through the drive-through window.
Okay, you're not supposed to do that.
It's frowned upon. No, don't do that. it's one of those things that seems really straightforward, but, you know, people have different expectations. People have a bad day, and you know, you're kind of trapped in the drive-through window. It's tragic in a way that somebody's going to lose their job over something that actually seemed really common sense. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all have to slow down, take a deep breath, and realize not everybody comes from the same place. Not everybody was raised the same way. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has the same view of the world. Mm-hmm. But we need to agree on, hey, when we're at work, you know, we're not going to punch our coworkers. We're not going to hit our coworkers with a chair. That was another one. And it's like, these are not unreasonable expectations. And as an employer, I want to make sure it actually never comes to that. I can't control people's behavior, but I can make my expectations clear.
So we've talked so far about middle skill jobs. We've talked about soft skills. Another kind of workforce jargony term that I want to ask you about that I've heard you talk about a lot and I think promote is upskilling. Mm-hmm. Can you define what does upskilling mean to you, and what is TWC's role in supporting upskilling?
Yeah. So you very rarely hear me say upskilling without also saying reskilling. Now, they're two different things, but they go together. Upskilling is basically, you do a job in the workforce, you're good at it. You could probably do a more in-depth or complicated job for higher wages, but you need a little bit of training to be able to get that. You have the aptitude for it. You've demonstrated your ability to do it. You still don't have the right credentialing or certification or something like that. So that's upskilling. Reskilling is look, technology drives all these jobs. Mm-hmm. Technology drives every job in the Texas economy. Doesn't matter what it is. And the drive of that technology changes those jobs. And so the nature of what you do is going to change over time. And so you're going to, in addition to upskill to get more skills to do a different job, presumably a higher paying job at a different level. Reskilling would be a situation of, I'm going to keep doing my same job, but, you know, like just in my career, when I started at the workforce, although truck stop cooks did not need to know Microsoft Excel, it wouldn't have mattered if I did because we didn't have Microsoft Excel. It hadn't been invented yet. Mm-hmm. But I use that almost every day, and I had to learn that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, like, no one's
that's immune. An example of reskilling.
That's reskilling. That's just, I need this skill now. I didn't need this skill.
To stay relevant.
Yeah. Upskilling is, oh, okay, I want to do this other thing, maybe at the same company, but I've got to get skills to do that. You also asked, like, what is TWC's role here? I think this is our role. You know, I think our high schools and community colleges and universities here in Texas, I actually think are really good. And when we stack them up against all the other states in the United States, we see, yeah, our high schools, community colleges, and universities are really good. They're giving people the foundation that they need. And they have their own agencies for that. You got Texas Education Agency for K-12. You've got Higher Education Coordinating Board for theirs. I think our real role comes in making sure there's this as orderly as possible, that people, again, are maximizing their full potential in the workforce and using their opportunities to upskill and reskill to ensure that's happening for two reasons. Mm-hmm. One, maximize your potential in the workforce. But two, I need you to get promoted so that the job you used to have is now available for one of the 350,000 people that's about to graduate high school this year. And some of the people that are moving to Texas because they want to move back home and they want to work here too. And if the workforce starts stagnating because you're not reskilling or upskilling, then it cuts other people out of a job as well. And this works a whole lot better when people are kind of moving themselves through the workforce so they can get that maximum potential, yes, but it really helps us understand where we're going to need workers, who's going to need workers, how we're going to need workers. And so I think our real niche becomes this reskilling and upskilling effort. High schools are doing their job, but things are naturally going to change. And you can't just like go back to high school. You can't do that. You could go back to community college, but you're probably not going to quit your job to do it. Mm-hmm. And so we have to look for opportunities for you to get your reskilling and upskilling while you're working so that this progression, this promotion that you have, that you're doing that with no disruptions to your career. Because if you're going to maximize your potential, you can't like just take a sabbatical every 2 years.
Yeah, few people have the luxury to just stop out.
Nobody really does, you know, because it stops your total momentum of what you're trying to get done.
Sure, thank you. All right, I want to talk to you about talent shortage math.
Yeah.
I noticed in your stats that you provided at the Texas Workforce Commission conference in December, you gave us the whole conference just a really powerful overview of the state of Texas, the state of the workforce, as you called it. And in those stats, you noted that while Texas has 545,557 job openings, we only have 458,000 hires that same month. So in other words, at that point in time, you noticed a gap of 90,000 unfilled positions. What's your take on the root cause of this gap? Is it a skills issue? Is it a location issue? Is it something else? Is it the soft skills? Is it middle skills? Is it upskilling, retraining? Like, what is the reason for this gap?
Yes.
Yes.
No, okay. No, the answer is it's actually all of the above. I mean, that's what drives. So, you know, if I'm giving you statewide numbers, I mean, understand this is a big place. A lot of people, 30 million live here, 15 and a half million are, you know, engaged in the workforce in some way. And also, you're not either because you're using the exact stats I gave you. You know, I'm not saying how many jobs were filled in 30 days, 45 days, 60 days, 90 days, because every employer has a different timeline. Some will wait till they find the perfect candidate. Some have to hire someone today. I don't read a lot into that gap. It's a fairly small gap. I mean, it's
okay, so you don't read much into the gap.
I don't read a lot into the gap between hires and jobs that are open. I think where I start, I use that data to start me down the road to understand where are the chronic gaps. Nursing is a great example of that. We're roughly, you know, somewhere around, we show 31,000 nursing positions that could be filled but aren't filled. Now, what does that mean? Like, how long has that been open? Is that aspirational on the part of the medical provider? There's a lot of questions that we would need to ask an employer. But I mean, I can confidently say, yeah, we're 31,000 nurses short from where we would want to be in Texas. That's a different answer than how many nurses do we need to have? Like, like when does healthcare stop happening?
Okay.
Some of that's growth. Some of that is just employers like wanting to be where they want to be in the marketplace. But I think it's instructive to note that at the same time, those stats you gave, you didn't tell the hundreds of thousands of people listening to us here today that the unemployment rate in Texas is 4.1%. And most economists will say like right at 4% is a good, healthy workforce. You also didn't tell them that we grow at about 1.92% a year, our workforce. You also didn't tell them that we average somewhere between 17 and 20,000 new jobs a month in our economy. And all of these statistics, you were not wrong not to say that, but these statistics don't operate independently of each other. I think when you reach a point when there's no more of something, that needs immediate attention. And I think when you reach this point of, okay, we're 31,000 nurses short of where we could be, we're probably ahead of where we absolutely have to be. Let's help healthcare providers, you know, continue to grow in the way they want to grow, because like we all want good healthcare when we live. You also asked the question about geographic distribution and all that. Well, look, nothing's geographically distributed because the state doesn't like say, okay, we're allowed to have this many here and that many there. We don't do that. We can't do that. That's not how good government works. I think what we do is we look at the region we're in. You and I live in a just like a super fast growing region of the state, and has been for 20 years. You know, hospitals' ability to hire here is going to be way different than it is in a town 150 miles to the west of here with 5,000 population. Still a shortage of nurses, but completely different reasons why there's a shortage of nurses. And I think using the statistics to understand the reality of what's on the ground, that's how you use statistics. And what it does is it help us, it really helps us to focus our answer on, okay, like how are we going to help these employers fill these jobs that they want to fill in a way that we really kind of use all of our available resources to help them do that. Educational providers, you know, other things that are going on in the workforce. So, A, I appreciate you paying attention to the slideshow I showed, and B,
of course,
appreciate your interest in the numbers.
But we've downloaded it and used it as a playbook internally for how we manage our, and I'm not just saying this to kiss up, Chairman. I'm saying it because it's true. Like, it's become a guidebook that we use for tailoring our business services.
But and thank you for that, because it's important that we think about this in terms of, like, how can, whether I'm at the Workforce Commission or I'm at a local board, like how can I use what I know to help make sure people get hired? Because that's, at the end of the day, that's what we want. Well, employers hire 100% of the people in this state. They create 100% of the jobs in this state. So some big portion of what we do is designed to make sure employers are getting what they need. We can help a whole lot of people in the workforce if we're certain of what employers are needing. And the statistics that we get describe for us kind of the state of where employers are and what they're trying to do.
So of all the statistics, and you said they're interconnected, is there one statistic you look at every week or regularly that is you feel like is the bellwether statistic for the state of Texas?
Oh man, there is no one bellwether statistic. The unemployment rate only tells us, you know, 30% of the story. It's always these combinations of things. But if I had to pick one statistic, I would tell you it's the labor force participation rate.
Okay, why that one?
Because it tells me how interested people are in continuing to work. And I look at the labor force participation rate by age group, and we're 2 points above the national labor force participation rate. So that's already good. And what I'm actually looking forward into the future on is I'm looking at age groups and seeing if people are dropping off their participation in the labor force. So I'm measuring the past against the present.
What has happened since COVID?
It's up. It's up across the board. There are more men, more women, more people in every age group, with the exception of one, and we need to talk about this in the podcast today, because the one and only group that their labor force participation rate is not up is 16 to 24. I actually think that's a problem, and probably not for the reason why you might think it is.
Why?
It's a problem because I don't think they're getting access to the jobs they're looking for. I think we have this notion that young people don't want to work. And what I'm actually seeing is people aren't moving up through the workforce. And so we're forcing young people who may have a degree in, you know, I don't know what, a finance. There's not a finance job for them that actually has any kind of return on the investment they made in their degree. So they go take a job, you know, at Buc-ee's or Chick-fil-A or somewhere that pays really well, because those places actually pay pretty well. Mm-hmm. And they do that because they can make the same money on their schedule.
So is that economics driven? Is it that you feel like people of older generations are staying in the workforce longer for economic reasons?
I don't think it's for economic reasons. I think we're healthier as a people. I think we have more opportunities. And I think we're learning that this model of I'm going to retire and then just be retired, I don't think that's as rewarding. And I think people have more opportunities to stay in the workforce. You know, it's interesting. Sure. Women participate in the workforce about 20 percentage points lower than men do. Hmm. And that's been consistent, really, as much as I can see the data. That's fairly consistent. Mm-hmm. And that's just going to be true. Women take time out of the workforce to maybe have a baby, or they're going to, you know, take care of their kids, or they're going to take care of their mom. And I think men probably do these things too, but not in the numbers that women do. It's not so much that women participate in the workforce less than men. That's not a concern to me. But more women are participating in the workforce today than was pre-pandemic. Hmm. And that's telling me people want to work and they want to be here. And that's true through all age groups. I think it makes sense. They get some satisfaction from their work. And if you've got a job you like, you're not as likely to retire from that and get out, you know, and then create this kind of domino effect to backfill that. So yeah, people are staying longer. I think they're staying in the same job longer. And I think what that's done is it's created a situation where at that entry levels, age 16 to 24, their labor force participation rate suffers for that, because they can do gig work. They've got a lot more options than I had. They don't have to be a cook in a truck stop. They've got different platforms where they can do one-off work, and that doesn't show up as employment. Mm-hmm. Are they making revenue? Yeah, they're making money doing some things that they're doing. Is it what they want to be doing? They'll tell you no. They'll also tell you that they're unemployed, even though they're generating revenue off of a, you know, some sort of platform, some sort of gig work platform particularly, because they're not doing the thing that they want to be doing. And so they show up as unemployed. They show up as not participating in the labor force, even though they have figured something out. That part hasn't changed generationally. But I think that number, when we see it dip for, you know, if men stop working, or if women stop working, or if, you know, age 36 to 45 stops working, then we know to start trying to figure out, okay, like, what's going on with this demographic group? Like, what's happening here? Why is it different than it has been for the last whatever? Why is the growth curve changed? You know, why has it gone negative? I mean, there's 1,000 questions we can and do ask, but that would be the one statistic. And nobody ever looks at that. It doesn't get reported in the news or anything. But the labor force participation rate is a very telling thing, particularly if your unemployment is as low as ours is.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. Chairman, I want to pick up on this theme of what you were just talking about, because I'm really fascinated in this 16 to 24-year-olds, not just because I happen to have a 21-year-old myself, but who's right now, frankly, trying to figure out what she's going to do. But what do you think the solution is for those of us, you and me, who are in the public workforce system? What can we be doing to help these 16 to 24-year-olds?
Well, that's a really open-ended question that has so many answers. But my kids are 25 and 23, and I mean, we've been doing some of this ourselves. I think helping this generation, let's finish high school. So let's say 18 to 24, because I think high schoolers are working. I mean, many work while they're in high school. We all did. But you know, it is a little different thing than now you're sort of trying to get out on your own. You're trying to make some things happen. I think there's this myth, this lore that has kind of sprung up that says, oh, I mean, you guys that graduated, you know, from college in 92, you just like stepped right into a job. No, nobody did their dream job. Like you did a job. You found something that could pay the bills. You figured out, you were still kind of learning how to live, you know, and you just knew that, okay, I'm going to take this job, but this is not my the job I really thought I was going to get when I got this degree or I got this certificate or I got this high school diploma. That's not the job I thought it was going to be. I don't think anybody really kind of steps into, you know, the job they envision. But then what happens is you get in the workforce and you realize none of these dream jobs actually exist. It doesn't actually matter what you're doing. It's like at no point in career day, unless you're an engineer or a doctor or an accountant, no one can really like tell you what that career is going to look like. I mean, at no point did, prior to the age of 40, did I ever say, all right, what I'm working toward is I'm going to work hard and get appointed to the Workforce Commission. I'm going to be a workforce commissioner. You know about these jobs. You know people have these jobs. And I think what you really start to realize is you have to do good work so that people notice what you're doing. And you do that good work, they notice what you're doing. And then when one of these kind of, you know, unusual or rare or limited kind of jobs come open, that you get on the list of people they're thinking about for that. And I think conveying to people 18 to 24, it's never not been a process. And it feels very oppressive, and it always has, because you're not really springing into the thing that you wanted. I think talking to them about that is helpful, because I think all of us, when we're struggling to find our footing, you know, it feels like everything's lined up against you. And I think the harshest lesson we all learn is that all of us who are adults, like, we're all just kind of making our way through this in our own way. You had this sense when you were a kid, like an actual kid, you know, like 10, 11, 12 years old. You had this sense that the adults in your life, like, clearly had things figured out.
Yeah.
And I think you don't want to believe that for a long time, that no, they don't.
Yeah.
They're making the best out of whatever life has brought to them. And some do it better than others. And, you know, some people are snappy dressers and others, you know, can't get their shirt on straight. I mean, it's like, that's what makes being a human being so interesting and oftentimes a lot of fun, is because we're all completely different and we're all trying to do it in our own way. And I can give you my playbook, but it's never going to apply to you 100%, because your playbook's going to be your playbook. Finding healthy ways to talk to this age group, I think, is important, because they need to understand, okay, you wanted to be a communications director, and you're actually the receptionist at an insurance company. That is not holding that young man back. He's gaining something by being the receptionist at that insurance company. Mm-hmm. And if he will keep working on those communication skills and doing things he can be doing, they will notice him.
Yeah, we learn something from everything
Absolutely.
That we do. You've been somewhat modest on this podcast so far, and you really haven't talked about specific programs at TWC. I'm wondering, when you think about the 16 to 24-year-olds, or really anyone, that workers in particular that we're trying to serve, or I guess employers too, is there a specific initiative of TWC, a program, a service, an initiative that is your favorite?
No, I don't have any favorites, because they are all designed to deal with something that we've identified as an issue for the workforce, whether it's the workforce itself or the employers that are employing that workforce. And so, no, the one right now, there are two right now that I am particularly on point about. One is rural communities, like actual rural communities, not rural feeling communities, but communities that actually have some population distance and density issues. And so I'm on that, because I think it's a solvable problem, but we've got to be very deliberate about it. And then I think anything dealing with upskilling and reskilling, because I think actually that's probably what's got us a little bit static in the workforce right now. And I think getting people of all ages to just address their immediate upskilling and reskilling opportunities, I think moves the needle for a lot of other things that we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things like Skills Development Fund, JET grants, Upskill Texas, these are TWC initiatives where an entity can get some grant dollars from us to do it. But the program itself is not particularly, you know, the important thing to me. It is an important tool that we have to address this problem of upskilling and reskilling. So rural communities have their own needs. We've kind of done that, you know, upskilling and reskilling. But, yeah, I mean, you know, our whole child care program solves a workforce problem. Things we do specific for foster youth solves a workforce problem. Veterans, workforce problem.
Yeah.
And you know, apprenticeships, we're not going to have time. That's a whole other podcast.
We haven't talked about internships or apprenticeships.
I'll invite myself back, because if we're going to talk about internships and apprenticeships, let's give it a whole podcast. Because this is an area Texas can do a lot more in.
Yeah.
We can be a lot more impactful in this. And we are poised to be able to do that, because a lot of work a lot of people have done, including TWC, and our boards, because these internships and apprenticeships are going to help turn around this 18 to 24 problem. It's also going to help in a lot of ways smooth out this upskilling and reskilling situation that we find ourselves in. So no, I don't have a favorite, but by the same token, I do probably assign my attention to things based on how much impact I think they're going to have in the workforce broadly, and then how much that's really going to move the needle for the whole state. Because at the end of the day, you know, I need to know that things are growing, people have opportunities. That's what keeps Texas economically where we find Texas today, which is very good. Like, we've had good leadership in this state. We've reached new heights in terms of the economy in this state. We do still see a lot of upside potential for the economy in this state, but we all kind of have to do our job to make sure that's going to happen, and this is my job to do.
So last question from me. Imagine no bureaucracy, unlimited budget. What would you want to do tomorrow to advance Texas's workforce competitiveness?
No bureaucracy.
Unlimited budget.
And an unlimited budget. Mm-hmm. I would probably put almost all of my efforts into identifying the educational and skills development tracks for all of our hard-to-fill jobs and design the appropriate apprenticeships for all of those, whatever they were. I would do that first, and I would spend however much money I could get on getting very predictable and successful pipelines put together, so that whether you're hiring electricians or you're hiring school teachers, you know exactly where you're going to get your next one, and you know that they're going to have the skills that they need. And I think apprenticeships, not the way we do federally registered apprenticeships now, not even the way we do our state recognized apprenticeships, but like designing custom apprenticeship programs for these sectors, I think would be an absolute game changer for this state. And I could really kind of rest easy that people were definitely going to have jobs for a long time into the future.
I love that vision. What I heard you say is, for hard to fill jobs, a explicit, understandable pathway in the form mm-hmm. of an apprenticeship to get into that job for every worker, every young person, mm-hmm. every student. That seems like the right kind of vision to have. Wow. I love it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your leadership at the state. I really enjoyed talking to you today. Enjoy getting to work with you at the Workforce Commission.
Well, we enjoy working with you too. You know, there's 28 boards, and
we're your favorite.
Every board's unique, and so we really are excited about boards that kind of understand the ecosystem in which they're operating and do a great job for their constituents. And I can definitely say that about the board that you lead. You have figured out what the people in your area want and need, and you deliver that thing. And it is fun to be able to talk about your success, because it makes a big difference in TWC's ability to be overall successful in the state. Every board's completely different. And, you know, to say this board's more successful than another, that can't be done. But what I can say is in the space in which a board's operating, are people happy with what they're delivering? And I can say that about Capital Area, because I think you guys have figured out, like, what it is that makes it possible for you to move the needle here. And you do those things. And that seems simple, but anybody that says it's simple, tell them to come do it for a day.
You
should have an apprenticeship program.
Exactly. I got a great team and a great board of directors and great support from TWC. So thank you, Chairman.
Well, I agree with all that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Austin Hires Local, powered by Workforce Solutions Capital Area. To learn more about what you heard today or to see what Workforce Solutions Capital Area can do for you, visit WFSCapitalArea.com. To stay updated on new episodes, subscribe to Austin Hires Local on your podcast app of choice. Until next time.